the United States, we have a trade problem.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, good morning. It's the Morning Open. I'm Steve Chiatakis, in for Bill Radke, who's back next week. The government today said Americans are buying more stuff, but it's more foreign-made stuff we're buying. Yet people in other countries aren't exactly returning the favor. It's called a trade deficit, and it's widened to its highest level in more than a year. More on that coming up. But first, where's Wall Street? The happy music today. The S&P up about 0.4%. The NASDAQ about 0.75% right now. The Dow up 48 points, 10,796. So the rally continues. In Europe, we have markets up anywhere between 1% and 2%. And major Asian markets dropped today amid concerns about global economic growth. Richard DeKayser is president of Woodley Park Research. He's with us live from Washington. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
Let's talk about this trade deficit, shall we? What's the takeaway there?
Well, world trade is booming, but our demand for foreign goods is growing faster than our sales abroad. So imports are up about 28% over the past year, and exports only 24%. So we're really seeing a transition. After 2 years of a narrowing trade gap, we're beginning to see things widen out, and I expect that will persist for some time.
And the good news is that we're buying more, right? It's just not as much American stuff that people far abroad are buying.
Well, that's right. That's right. This is part of the business cycle. When the U.S. was in recession, we weren't stocking warehouses with inventory. We were paring back, and that means fewer imports, and now things are going in the other direction. So part of this is simply a reflection of the improving U.S. economy and our demand for foreign goods.
What do we do to get other countries to buy our stuff?
Well, the surest way to turn this around, that is to see our trade gap continue to decline, is to cheapen the dollar. Now, the dollar has actually risen a bit in the past couple of months, mostly because of the financial crisis in Europe. Investors have fled the euro and moved into the dollar. But if things there get back on track, as increasingly seems likely, we should see the dollar weaken some more, and that makes U.S. goods more competitive overseas.
Richard DeKayser in Washington, D.C. Richard, thanks.
My pleasure.
You can use your smartphone to find just about anything these days. Friends, the nearest pizza place, a store that sells, I don't know, green hair dye. It's called location-based marketing, and now the world's largest social network is about to get in on the geolocation game. Reporter Janet Babin has more.
Facebook hasn't revealed much about its new service, but it would be the biggest player in location-based marketing. Larry Weber is chairman of marketing services company W2. He says geolocation could help Facebook's 400 million users find each other.
You want to know where your friends are, or, gee, I graduated from this college in 1992. I wonder if anybody I graduated with is in New York today.
Businesses would like to know who's in New York today, too, and just about everywhere else.
Retail is about location and mindset, so it gets two of those down, and it's facilitated by groups of friends. That's a lot going for it.
That's Greg Warren, an executive with MediaVest, a media buying firm. He says with Facebook's new service, advertisers could target people nearby and offer them deals to get them in the door. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Listening to the Marketplace Morning Report for Wednesday, May 12, 2010, at marketplace.org. The United Kingdom has a new prime minister. Conservative David Cameron formed a fragile coalition government with rival Liberal Democrats. Now, the Conservatives claim to be more business-friendly than their political rivals, and traders seem to agree. But many political observers question the power-sharing deal that put Cameron in charge. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us in London to talk about it. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
So what type of government's been formed?
It's a full coalition government with the Conservatives in the driving seat. They have the key posts of Prime Minister, Finance Chief and Foreign Secretary, while the Liberal Democrats have five cabinet posts, including that of Deputy Prime Minister. This is very unusual for Britain. This is the first time since the Second World War that Britain will be governed by more than one party.
Since World War II. Okay, so I can imagine there must have been some drama involved in all this.
Yes, 5 days of intense negotiations between the parties, culminating in this dramatic moment yesterday evening when Prime Minister Gordon Brown made the traditional trek up to Buckingham Palace to hand in his resignation to the Queen. It's called the Kissing of Hands. That's the ceremony. The Queen then, as custom dictates, formally invited Conservative leader David Cameron to form a new government.
Stephen, can this coalition last?
David Cameron says, yes, it can, it must, and the Liberal Democrat leader Nick Clegg is optimistic.
I hope this is the start of the new politics where politicians of different persuasions come together, overcome their differences in order to deliver the good government for the sake of the whole country.
But it's going to be tricky. The two parties have their differences over economic policy in particular. Cynics say it won't be too long before the two parties are fighting like ferrets in a sack.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard joining us from London. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
Investors are keeping an eye out for another bubble, this one in China. Gas, food, and consumer prices are way up. So now a key Chinese bank advisor says it's time to raise interest rates. From Shanghai, here's Marketplace's Scott Tong.
The central bank advisor says he frets about the danger of inflation. Consumer prices in China rose almost 3% in April, the most in a year and a half. Some call that a negative real interest rate. Bad for bank customers, bad for banks. Economist Paul Cavey works for a bank, Macquarie Securities.
Interest rates are very low in China, and therefore any rate of inflation already causes real interest rates to be negative. And that's a very strong argument for interest rates to rise.
Argument number two is home prices. Real estate prices sizzled up 12.8% over the past year, reigniting talk of a China housing bubble. If China does hike interest rates, some investors fear it'll cool things down too much. That would hurt Chinese demand for things like American cars, iPhones, and U.S. debt. Economist Cavey thinks Beijing has another tool in the kit that it will employ very soon, strengthening the currency. That would make it cheaper for Chinese consumers to buy foreign goods and moderate inflation pressure. One added benefit, it would moderate political pressure from Washington. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Senators John Kerry and Joe Lieberman are unveiling their energy and climate bill today, but the legislation faces a big uphill battle. It doesn't have any Republican co-sponsors, and Senate leaders may settle on a scaled-down measure. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
The Senate bill being introduced today is expected to set a cap on domestic greenhouse gas emissions, but Senate leaders are leaning toward a smaller energy bill. It requires utilities to get 15% of their power from renewable sources like solar and wind power by 2021. It would be the first ever federal mandate on renewable energy.
A number of states have already done this, but there's been no federal requirement. So it would be a modest step.
That's Clean Air Watch President Frank O'Donnell. If you're thinking he doesn't sound too enthused, you're right. He says the legislation's definition of renewable energy is too broad. It includes things like nuclear power. Marchant Wentworth is a lobbyist with the Union of Concerned Scientists. He says the oil spill in the Gulf gives the bigger energy bill a boost.
Actually, this focuses American people on the need for, progress on, moving away from carbon fuels.
The House passed a sweeping energy bill almost a year ago. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
If you hire a bank to help you invest your money and both of you get in over your heads, who's on the hook when things go bad? A trial in Minnesota is testing whether one of the country's biggest banks owes its clients for getting them into some risky investments. Reporter Jeff Horwich has more.
Big bank knows its investments are risky, but doesn't come clean. So far, it's playing out like a Midwestern Goldman Sachs, complete with embarrassing emails. Mike Cerisi is the attorney for three foundations and a state workers' comp fund suing Wells Fargo. He showed the jury internal Wells Fargo documents debating whether to tell clients about their sour investments. One refers to investors as hostages.
Their CEO and chairman testified that the investments that they made into certain areas were ones that took enormous risk. They've also described them as being goofy investments.
Cerisi says the foundation signed on for investments that were low risk and easy to cash out. Instead, they got subprime mortgages, commercial paper, and Lehman Brothers. Wells Fargo says these foundations are sophisticated institutional investors. They saw the fine print, signed on the dotted line, and knew there was risk. Terry Fruth is a securities lawyer in Minneapolis. He says the foundations weren't the only ones feeling clueless.
The delicious irony is that the biggest institution in this game, Wells Fargo, didn't understand what they were doing.
In fact, Wells Fargo says most of the money lost in this particular investment pool was its own. Fruth says the jury in St. Paul has to answer one of the toughest questions from the financial crisis, when everyone involved is out of their depth.
Who should be responsible under the law in knowing what they're doing?
If the answer is the bank, Fruth is ready for the lawsuit floodgates to open. He represents another nonprofit lining up to sue Wells Fargo. In St. Paul, I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
Financial advisors recommend that people have a living will, just in case. So why not banks? The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the FDIC as we know it, has proposed another reform aimed at the too-big-to-fail problem. From Washington, here's Marketplace's John Dimsdale.
The FDIC wants major banks to be prepared for their own death. The top 40 banks would have to submit a detailed plan for their own dismantling in the event of financial collapse. That would include a way to separate consumers' money, insured by the government, from the complex financial institutions that own many federally insured banks. FDIC Chairman Sheila Bair supports the proposal, saying early planning will help avoid the need for bailouts. But Scott Talbot, with the Bank Trade Association Financial Services Roundtable, worries that the living will sitting at the FDIC would quickly become outdated.
The markets change quickly, as do banks, and so the shelf life of any living will would be short-lived.
He says all the responsibility shouldn't be on banks. Regulators should work with them continuously to plan for problems. The living will proposal is open for a 60-day comment period. After that, the FDIC has the authority to make it a requirement without the need for congressional legislation. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Gas prices usually go up in the summertime, so you'd think transit systems would take advantage of people wanting to flee their cars and SUVs. Los Angeles Times columnist David Lazarus says they're not doing enough wooing of the masses to mass transit. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
Are people more inclined, do you think, because gas prices are going up, and typically in the summer they do go up, do you think they're more inclined to use mass transit?
They will be. We saw when pump prices approached $4 or so in California last time, ridership went up. But as soon as pump prices started coming down again, ridership went down. So obviously, when gas prices go up again, and they will, we will see ridership coming up with them. But that's not going to be enough to get a lot of these systems over the hump. For example, the LA County Metropolitan Transportation Authority, it's the big dog in Southern California.
Oh, yeah.
They're looking at a $181 million budget shortfall coming up in the next fiscal year. So I don't care how much ridership comes up as a factor of pump prices. You've got to bring it up even higher to put this thing in the black. And I don't think they're concentrating on that.
So convince me. I'm on the fence. I can, if I wanted to, use mass transit. Why should I?
Well, let's say that it was not only an easier thing to do, but it was actually a more productive thing to do. I mean, for example, I spent a couple of hours on the freeway every day. It's a miserable time.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm listening to the radio, but I could be making much better use of my time. Let's say that public transportation was able to offer comfort. The buses need to be clean. They need to be comfortable. Let's say there was Wi-Fi on board. You take out your iPad. You take out your laptop. Suddenly, the bus becomes far more attractive than the car. That's what public transportation needs to be selling.
You say it's doable. Will it be done?
It's tricky. Right now, it looks like a lot of transit operators nationwide see themselves as little islands. They look at how do we meet our nut, how do we get our fares up, instead of how do we integrate with other transit systems in our region so that people will find this as a good way to traverse vast geographies, which is increasingly the case as people live farther and farther from their jobs. They're not doing that. Bus lanes will help. Express lines will help. Information technology. There should be websites in every metropolitan region that will bring all of the transit systems together, including their schedules, including where they run, and help people figure out a route that'll get from point A to point B using multiple systems. Ease of use, that's what they need to be selling.
David Lazarus from the Los Angeles Times. David, thanks.
Thank you.
And finally, for those who navigate the concrete jungle every day only to work extra hours, you're not going to like the reward. A British study found workers who clock 3 to 4 hours of overtime a day have higher incidence of heart problems. That doesn't even take into account those who are unhealthy to begin with. Say bosses who demand such devotion, thanks for putting your heart into it. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. Catch us online at marketplace.org, and I'm tweeting at ChiotakisMMR. This is the Marketplace Morning Report.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.